Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. I said I have to remember to say Senate since this is a new role for me. I want to welcome everybody and thank you for coming. We're going to start with a little bit of introductions. First, I'm going to say it's an honor and a privilege to be here. Certainly, somebody has a BlackBerry or cell phone on. And I'll remind everybody to please turn off your BlackBerry, cell phones, whatever, because as you can see, that's what it does to our very sensitive sound system here. So it's an honor and a privilege to be here today and chair this august committee. I sort of feel like I've sort of put the gavel down on the other side and coming over here, but it's very exciting, and I think that this the committee members that we have here, as you can see, are all very experienced folks on this issue. I've served for how many years were we on Ag and Natural Resources together?
Two terms. 4 years.
For 4 years with now Senator Boquist, and I've worked with all of the other senators here, so it's very exciting and very appreciative that folks were willing to serve on this committee. I'm not sure they had a choice, but that they were willing to serve on this committee. And a lot of familiar faces in the room. We do have new colors and new carpeting. We had a little incident, so we got a facelift. First, I'd like to introduce our staff. And, of course, you know that we cannot do the jobs that we do without our staff. And I always joke that they're the brains behind the operation for many of us, both our personal staff and our committee staff. But I'd like to welcome Beth Herzog. She's actually been working during the interim, but we're very privileged to have her staffing this committee this session. And I'm going to ask her to introduce herself and then also introduce the committee staff.
Again, my name is Beth Herzog, and I am very excited to be working here. I started in April with the legislature. Before that, I was getting my master's in Vermont, so I'm back and excited to be on the Pacific Northwest again. Excited to be working. And with our committee assistant for the session is Natalie Worley, who also was here during the February short session. So she has some experience with the Oregon legislature also. So we're both very excited to be working with the committee.
And Beth worked previously with
the Washington State Legislature
as well. So she's not new to the legislative process and also has some insights about how our neighbors to the north work. I am going to ask everybody to do introductions. I'll start off by saying that this is my eighth year in public service. Obviously moved over from the other chamber. I served 4 years in the House of Representatives and very excited about being in the state Senate. My district is District 23, which is the northeast-south center. It's the center of the universe, but I'll say the center part of Portland, northeast and southeast Portland. I actually have the Columbia River in my district and then goes further south, all within Multnomah County. And I do have a background on environmental issues, as some of you know. I've been working professionally on environmental issues for about 25 years. And it is very exciting to be here. I know it's going to be a challenging time on many fronts, but I think we have the opportunity to put forth some innovative and hopefully productive legislation. And I really see this committee working together as a team. I would like all the committee members to introduce themselves, and if you want to share maybe one personal note about what you did over your holiday vacation. Some of you know I was off traveling, and traveling is a hobby. I was in the Middle East looking at water projects, partially. I was actually at the Aswan Dam later in December. It was quite fascinating. So I'm going to ask everybody to talk a little bit about what they did over the holidays. I have a feeling a lot of people were shoveling snow, but I fortunately missed out on that. I think we're going to start with my vice chair, who I'm honored to serve with.
Well, thank you very much. I have been on this here committee for 10 years, spanning two centuries.
Funny, you don't look that old.
Believe me, I feel it. I'm Jay Snackinson, and I'm happy to be here.
You want to say where you're from and what you did for your holiday vacation?
Madam Chair, he's a southern man.
Yeah.
I'm from
maybe a couple of counties that you represent.
I represent Jackson County, Josephine County, the good state of Jefferson on occasion. For my summer vacation, summer winter vacation, I read a lot of books and took a lot of drugs. Legal, that is.
Well, we're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Mark Hess. I'm in the Senate. I was appointed in the interim and elected in November. I was in the House for three terms. And I did spend some time chipping away ice and shoveling snow over the holiday break, but it was still a good holiday, and I'm excited to be here.
And Mark's a fairly new dad, second time around.
10 months.
It's exciting. It's amazing that your wife let you do this with a 10-month-old. That's all I can say. But she's a very generous person. So, Senator Boquist?
I'm Brian Boquist, 12th Senate District, which is 6 voters in Lane County, rural Benton, rural Lynn, rural Marion, rural Yamhill, rural Polk, and a couple of cities scattered in between there. And during my interim, I did shovel snow so that I could get down so I could shovel manure out of the barn.
So. I thought you were going to say shovel manure somewhere else. But great.
Hey, I'm Floyd Przonski, State Senator for District 4. That takes in a good portion of Lane County on the east and south sides of the county, and Douglas County on the north and east sides of that county. This is my third legislative session as a senator, and served on the Environment and Natural Resources this last time, and I'm honored and pleased to be serving on this committee again.
Thank you all, and I will, in full disclosure, you know you have 3 members of the Biker Caucus up here too, so you may know where to find us on some sunny days. Sort of, how do we all get on the same committee? It's interesting. I will tell you, though, I still don't think we can keep up with Senator Atkinson. But anyway, it's great to have everybody here. I will entertain a motion. One of the first things we need to do, actually, I'm sorry, I'm going to have Beth talk a little bit about the rules, because in order for us to proceed, we have to adopt our rules. Beth's going to talk a little bit about them, and then we'll see if there's a motion and any discussions.
The rules we distributed yesterday, and you should have a copy in front of you. I think everyone should be fairly familiar with them. I would say that the only noticeable change probably from the last session is that they're asking that we have, as a requirement, a fiscal and revenue impact statement in committee in front of us to consider before we pass the bill or any amendments out of committee. So that would be probably the biggest change from the last. And if anyone has any questions.
Okay. Senator Atkinson?
Beth, we're on 48 hours right now for notice. Is that right?
48 hours, yes. There was a section that allowed us within the first week for informational hearings to have 24-hour notice, but for the remainder of session, 48.
Okay. And so, just for the record, what constitutes a majority for a quorum?
For a quorum, in this committee, it would be 4 people for a 5-person committee. Or, excuse me, 3 people for a 5-person committee.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Sorry.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move the rules as presented for the committee.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. These are dated January 15th, 2009. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Przonski?
Aye.
Senator Hatt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
And Chair Dean
Felder? Aye. So with that, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. Okay. Do I need to open up an informational?
Yeah, maybe so.
Okay. Thank you for first order business. And now I'm going to open up an informational hearing on energy efficiency. Members, we have some invited guests that are going to provide some background information, preparation of some of the bills that we'll be hearing today. We have a pretty full agenda, but certainly encourage if there's questions, that's why they're here. We've asked some folks who've been working in this field for quite a while. First up, we have the Energy Efficiency Working Group. We have a couple members, and one of them chaired the working group, and I just want to say that the folks who worked on this, I don't know how many months they served, or years, probably felt like years. Many of them did it as volunteers. Obviously, unless they were representing somebody, they weren't paid, and appreciate the hard work that went into many, many hours of meetings. Probably some of you received the minutes, or hopefully were alerted to these work group meetings. They're all, I know, on public record, and they're all on the governor's website. But first, we're going to hear from the Energy Efficiency Working Group and their recommendations. Then we're going to hear from some of the other organizations working on energy efficiency. Of course, the Department of Energy is going to come up and talk a little bit about their programs. We're going to hear from the Energy Trust, from a couple of other groups that have been working on energy efficiency for quite a while. So with that, I'd like to invite David Cohen and Bill Edmonds up. Bill Edmonds is with Northwest Natural, and David Cohen's with Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. And again, please make sure and introduce yourself for the record. And you'll have a few minutes, and then we'll open up for questions. Thanks for coming here. I know Mr. Edmonds was recently in front of my House committee, so he probably feels like it's a little bit of redo, but for some of my members, it's new.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Bill Edmonds. I'm the co-chair of the Governor's Energy Efficiency Working Group. I am also the Environmental Policy and Sustainability Director at Northwest Natural. Thank you very much for having us to hear some about the working group, how it operated, and the recommendations we came up with. Seated with me is David Cohen. He's from the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, and he'll be helping me describe some of the recommendations that came out of our working group. I should mention that my other co-chair was Clark Brockman from Sierra Architects. He was unable to be with us today, but we couldn't have accomplished what we did without him. Very much appreciate his hard work. I'll be giving you a quick little background on energy efficiency and its importance, the importance for the state in terms of helping people keep their bills low, and also the importance in terms of helping to reach our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And then we'll move through the most important of the recommendations that came out of the working group. So first, a little background. The region has a history of successful efforts to reduce energy usage, and it's been substantial, and it's been a bargain. It's been substantial in that if you look at the entire region, the Northwest Power Planning Council says that we've saved enough energy to serve all of Idaho and to serve western Montana. A ton of energy we've saved through our hard work. It's been a bargain. This energy efficiency has helped us save $1.3 billion as of 2005 and lowered emissions of greenhouse gases by 13.5 million tons. All this, as the Northwest Power Planning Council explains, as energy prices continue to go up. Oregon's been recognized for doing a lot to make this happen as a leader within the region and as a leader within the country. The American Council for the Energy Efficient Economy, or they're called ACEEE, comes out with a scorecard every year stacking up the states to say, if you look at all the policies and the programs, how do the states compare? When that scorecard came out, we were number two in the nation based on a look at our programs and policies. Number one was California, I'll mention. Always stings to be number two to them, but I think we've done a lot to deserve that silver medal. I'll go through a couple of those things. In terms of policies, of course, adopted in many cases by this legislature, the business and residential energy tax credit has done a lot to save energy. 10,000 Oregon businesses are saving energy because of the BETC. 20,000 Oregonians are saving $300 million on their energy bill because of these programs. So those are the type of things that ACEEE has noticed and really commended our state for doing to drive efficiency. It's also notable that our energy efficiency building code are the most stringent in the nation, and ACEEE has noticed that too, saying it saved homeowners $160 million a year, reducing energy costs for them, and for businesses $120 million. So again, those are the type of things ACEEE commends policymakers for in Oregon. Later in the day, you'll be hearing from Margie Harris in terms of the programs that emanate from those smart policies. Margie Harris is the executive director of the Energy Trust, and I think as probably all of you know, the Energy Trust is the delivery arm for energy efficiency in partnership with the utilities, like my utility, Northwest Natural. You'll hear much more about this from her, but the Energy Trust has saved 190 average megawatts of electricity and 9.1 million annual therms of gas. Those are numbers that not everyone they resonate with people. Another way to say it is taking that energy saved and the renewables they've helped make happen, that's enough power to serve 250,000 homes. In a metric we could all understand, that's enough to serve Salem, Medford, Klamath Falls, and LeGrand, some cities I just put together to get to that 250,000 homes. So a ton of energy we've saved. Can we rest on our laurels and say, well, it looks like we're number two and we're proud of it and we've done enough? There's lots more to do to hit that very ambitious greenhouse gas target set by the legislature. I think, as you know, it's to begin reducing greenhouse gas emissions today, but to hit the very ambitious 75% reduction by 2050. The governor, in recognizing that energy efficiency is the cornerstone of how we're going to do that, set up an energy efficiency working group. Dave Bandhoff, the sustainability advisor, set it in motion. It was made up of 31 members, many of whom are in this room, some of whom you'll hear from today. And we had liaisons from the state agencies that were are close to this issue. We started our work in April. And we ended it in August. So you can see it was, I've been referring to it as more of a sprint than a distance event. We didn't have time to kind of get our pace on this issue and mull over ideas. We had to sprint out of the blocks. We did some brainstorming. We put them in buckets. We figured out which were the biggest issues that we could, put some meat on the bones for. And then we brought those forward to the governor. We'll be going through the seven big ideas that we came up with that received the most support. And I say most, and that should be underlined or put in quotes or something. We did not achieve consensus on these items. And as you take testimony on these bills, I think that will become clear. There were very strong proponents for many of these big ideas, but there were also strong opinions in the audience, in our group, that said this is not the way to go. So be aware that these are not consensus items, but they were broadly appealed to by a large number in our group. Let's see. I think I'll leave there and turn to David Cohen, who's going to go through two of the big ideas that we surfaced, and then I'll take up from there and go through the remainder.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Cohen. I work for the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. I am the Senior Manager of Codes and Standards there. The Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance is a regional nonprofit organization which encourages the production and development and adoption of energy-efficient products and services. We work in the four Northwest states, and we are funded by public benefits administrators such as the Energy Trust of Oregon, the Bonneville Power Administration, and electric utilities around the region. I've been asked to talk about two concepts today, one directly touching on new construction and the other on existing buildings. It's important, just as an introduction, to address both of them if you want to save a lot of energy. At any given point, most of the buildings, of course, are existing. However, each year, depending on the economic cycle and whether there's a building boom, anywhere from 1 to 3% of the overall square footage is replaced or added to. So over time, if you haven't made those buildings that are being constructed more efficient, you will end up with a building stock of inefficient buildings. So you want to hit the new ones as they're being built, and then the ones that are already existing, many of which were built a long time ago before there were energy codes, you want to get them updated. The first legislative concept that the working group addressed that I want to talk about is the 2030 Carbon Neutral Reach Code for New Construction. And it addressed two problems. One was that the Oregon Building Codes Division administers the codes, but it currently has no energy efficiency targets and there's no direction to require reductions in energy use. And then the second issue was that there's no predictability in energy codes. So the legislative concept that we came up with was to direct the Building Codes Division to adopt more stringent codes, or I should say to have the legislature direct them to adopt more stringent codes, and then to also adopt a reach code, or it's also called an aspirational code. So currently, when new codes are adopted, there's a public process, and it's quite involved. It lasts 12 or 14 months, At a certain point, a board adopts the code, and then 6 months later, it's implemented. But at the time it goes through this process and it's adopted, nobody has any idea until the final day what that code's actually going to contain. So you can imagine if you're a builder or a tradesperson of some sort, that's a little problematic, knowing that 6 months later you're going to have to start building your buildings differently. So a REACH code, the idea is that you would be adopting these codes, but at the same time, you would adopt a REACH code which would be voluntary for 3 years, but then go into effect as the mandatory code at the next cycle. So you'd always be one step ahead. And the benefits of this are that it provides design and construction professionals with 3 years of lead time to prepare for new requirements. It's very important that it motivates manufacturers, distributors, and retailers to start stocking products and to get prices down because they know that there's going to be a demand for it. It's effectively guaranteed since it's going to be in the code afterwards. And it also allows voluntary programs that are run by the Energy Trust of Oregon, the Bonneville Power Administration, utilities, and my organization to focus some of their financial incentives and education and training activities on products and services that they know will become mandatory, which ensures that you'll have large impacts and reduce the maximum amount of energy over time. This approach would be the first time in the country that any state has adopted it, so we could be national leaders if we went with this. And then the last thing, not the last thing, but the current draft bill, this is the only thing I'll refer to for the draft bill itself. It does refer to this REACH code or aspirational code, but it doesn't make the link, the direct link between the current code and it becoming the current code later. So when you go into committee, it would be great if that link could be reestablished, because that was, in my mind, the strength of the original proposal. The Energy Efficiency Working Group reaction, as Bill said, there was not consensus on all of these. And this concept, this legislative concept, received the second most votes in support, strong support from the group. However, it was also the most contentious. And in large part, I believe that's because of the mandatory nature of codes. So there were some organizations which might generally support energy efficiency. However, they prefer voluntary methods and incentives, and they oppose mandatory approaches on both economic and philosophical grounds. So in the absence of questions, I'm going to move on to an existing building legislative concept. Thank you. This was called the Local Energy Improvement District Financing concept, and the problems it was trying to address were to reduce energy consumption in existing buildings and then also raising and investing capital. In order to retrofit an existing building, you need a lot of money. It's relatively inexpensive in the design phase to just say add a little more of this or do this, but once the building's built, you know, if you think about windows where it's a couple dollars a square foot to put in a better window, but once the house is built and you have to take the siding and the molding off, you're talking $10,000 or $15,000 to change out those windows. So part of the discussion in the working group was we may be talking about extremely large amounts of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, in order to make a serious dent in the energy use in existing buildings. And given the magnitude of money that was needed, there was complete agreement that you somehow needed to get the financial markets involved. This wasn't going to be done purely through tax revenues or anything that came through the state or regulatory methods. So there were specific discussions mainly around the mechanisms through which such financing could be delivered in a way that would, A, motivate a large proportion of homeowners and building owners to participate, to use existing infrastructures to deliver the financing part of the program, and then to ensure repayment of the money to the financial markets. And the approach that's in the legislative concept that was largely endorsed by the group was this local improvement district concept. The idea is that jurisdictions raise capital through bond sales, and then they use that money to make the buildings and homes dramatically more energy efficient. In order to repay these bonds, they increase the property taxes inside the district, and then they use the money to make payments on the bond. However, there is no net impact on the people within the district, because the taxes go up however you've spent money to reduce the energy use in the building. So those two net out, you know, in theory at least, to zero. In reality, you know, there'd be some plus and minus, but almost everybody would see a net of zero. Some might see a little bit less, some a little bit more. And the reason legislation is needed is that there are certain statutes out there that currently don't allow public bodies to establish local improvement districts. So you need to correct that in the legislature. The benefits to this are very large. You can imagine that amount of money going into the economy. Tremendous numbers of jobs would be either maintained in the building and trades industry or created. It would increase the value of buildings themselves, and there would be a long-term reduction in monthly costs to the owners. This received unanimous support from the Energy Efficiency Working Group. The only groups who we think might have questions or concerns about it are schools or community colleges and local governments, because property owners would face higher property tax assessments to pay for those bonds, and therefore they might be less willing to finance measures that would have bonding for schools or other items that are of interest to those organizations. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, first of all, I just want to remind folks, by the way, that we have new microphones, so you don't have to, 3 to 6 inches, and that is all you have to sit. We're used to, you know, sitting really close, so the sound actually is better if you sit a little further back. With that, I have a couple of questions to ask you.
I'm going to come back to just a couple more, or would you like to handle some questions directly on those
points? It's about this list, so do you want to make final comments?
I have a couple more concepts, maybe if we finish the concepts, if that works for you. All right. Madam Chair and committee members, four more concepts. Appreciate the two that you have just been covered were some of the meatiest and more difficult ones. So I appreciate David going over those. These are a little, perhaps a little simpler, and I can be a little more, a little quicker on them. Getting the codes right and getting the financing right is critical. I think everyone would agree, though, we need to help people living in existing homes sort of climb the learning curve about energy. When we buy a car, for example, there's a miles per gallon sticker on that car, and we're all smarter purchasers of the car because of that miles per gallon sticker. A much larger purchase, your home purchase, probably your largest purchase of your life, or even a commercial purchase of a building, at that point you have very much less information about the operating costs, if you will, of the home, as well as the energy use of that home. The Energy Performance Score, or EPS, is designed to solve that problem. The Energy Performance Score would be provides an analysis of the energy use of the home. It would show you that your home is now a 12, but if you use if you put in all the efficiency measures available, it could be a score of an 18, and that information would be available at the time of your home purchase, and that would allow you to say, well, I've got one house that's an 18, one that's a 10, maybe I'll negotiate for them to turn that 10 into an 18 and purchase that one. It becomes a deal point at the time of purchase, and would make energy and energy sort of increase the energy wisdom at that moment of the sale. There's some pilot projects underway to test various EPS methodology. The committee pretty much universally agreed that this is a good thing, and I think where the disagreement is exactly how does it work, exactly when is it required, or is it not yet ready to be mandatory? But I think all agreed that we need to increase knowledge of energy at the time of purchase. The next concept has to do with low-income weatherization and affordable housing. At a time of high energy prices, obviously there's those in our community who are most vulnerable. Low-income energy users are not, in general, handled by the programs offered by the Energy Trust. The Energy Trust provides incentives but doesn't get you all the way to the cost of the measure. So the low-income population is helped by community community action agencies that actually pay the entire cost of a measure when they go into a home. The problem has been a shortage of funds to do all the homes that need to be done. And so there was a broad agreement of our group that we need to find ways. There's sort of two channels you can take when dealing with a low-income population. Either set the bar high for energy efficiency and exempt these customers because it costs too much. Our panel definitely thought that was not the way to go, if at all possible. Better yet, include low-income homes in the high standards for both codes and weatherization, but find a way to help pay for those costs. In a time when funds are short, that's obviously very difficult to do. The good news is there's more federal money coming for low-income weatherization, and there's a bill in place that would create basically a matchmaker program in the $4 million area, which I know is going to be a challenge in this legislative session, but it was, again, received broad support from our committee. The business energy tax credit, we had industrial customers on our around the circle of 31 members, and they brought a very impassioned plea that there are a lot of energy efficiency sort of on the table at their businesses that is not getting funded. As you probably recall, the Betsy moved for some projects from 35% to 50% last legislative session, but for industrial energy efficiency programs, it's still at 35%. And they explained that in tough economic times like today, it's very important that these very cost-effective energy efficiency programs for industrial customers receive a 50% Betsy so that they can get sort of over the hurdle and get done in these difficult economic times. Recognizing that Betsy funding is tough, I think there was also broad agreement that ODO, Oregon Department of Energy, should be involved in helping to screen which projects get through, making sure that these projects require a 50% Betsy before they receive funding. And then the very last area, and I'm going to give this a short shrift because you have some expertise following me, but in the area of education outreach and workforce training, again, broad agreement that to do energy efficiency right, we need a broad outreach so that people understand the programs that we've designed, and we need workforce training. These aren't going to just sort of miraculously get done without a workforce trained up to help make them happen. The energy performance score, for example, is a good example. People need to understand. They understand that what a sticker on the refrigerator means. They need to help. They need a lot of help, I think, understanding what a sticker on the house means. There's also a whole workforce that needs to be trained up and ready to go to help implement such a program. So in general, the group said, I don't think we can just pull out education outreach and workforce and make it a bill. Rather, if we're going to make smart policy here, we need to tuck those concepts into each of our proposals to make sure things like the energy performance score can be adequately implemented. With that, David and I would be glad to take some questions.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Just a couple of quick questions and then open up for the panel. And the handout that you've provided that lists the sort of concepts, and not all of them require legislation, as my understanding, like the education outreach and workforce training, but several of them, and the reason you're here is because we're going to be hearing them through this committee. Could you help identify, and you've talked about some of them already, but ones that did receive unanimous support, I think you had mentioned the local energy improvement district financing that will be in the form of legislation at some point. Are there others here that overwhelmingly, you know,
In terms of sort of characterizing their support, one way is that each of the ones that are listed, the seven, we actually had 12 that went forward to the governor. The seven listed here all had 75% of the committee support. So that's broad support. What it doesn't characterize is sort of the passion of of those who didn't support it. And
I'm sure we'll be hearing from them.
And you'll hear from them. I think it's fair to say that the 2030 carbon neutral buildings, mm-hmm. David suggested, has the most passion around it, and that honestly, other than that, I would say that there is fairly broad support. I certainly don't want to call it unanimous for the other proposals.
I think I'm going to start using passion instead of opposition in all of my discussions in this building in the future. I like that. It's really enlightening. So. I also want to thank you again for your hard work. I know that you guys met quite a bit in that short time frame, but obviously accomplished a lot. And certainly we look forward to hearing more during the actual public testimony for the bills. But as far as also what other, I'm assuming you looked at what other states were doing and what was consistent with the region. Was that discussions occurred in your meetings?
Yes, I think the charge from the governor was to come up with big ideas, and I think no one would say that we didn't come up with big, fresh ideas. In some ways, some of these truly are cutting-edge ideas. The energy performance score is being piloted here, but is not something that's broadly done around the country. The 2030, as David mentioned, has not been adopted by other states. So these are big ideas. We thought about some smaller ideas about light bulb giveaways and that kind of thing, and they were pretty much discarded with the idea that this is really was an effort to come up with ideas that aren't necessarily being kicked around yet and deserve at least some attention from the legislature.
Great, thank you. Questions from the panel? Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you again, I'm sure, soon. Okay, next I'd like to invite Betty Merrill up, who's the Assistant Director of the Conservation Division for the Oregon Department of Energy. And Betty's going to provide just an overview of the department's programs, and also if you want to comment on the, did you staff the working group?
Yes, we did.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Betty Merrill, Oregon Department of Energy. We kind of didn't coordinate well with the Energy Efficiency Working Group. What's being handed out to you is a brief summary of the bills, energy bills that were passed last session for your review, and a list of the bills that will be coming forward this session. Four of those bills are from the Energy Efficiency Working Group.
Thank you.
The Department of Energy began in the 70s, and our mission has always been for energy efficiency and to promote renewable energy within the state of Oregon. As you've heard, we've been recognized nationally for our leadership in energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. The agency has worked with all of the utilities, the U.S. Department of Energy, and our regional neighbors to form collaborative groups to move energy efficiency and renewable energy forward. In the last session, there were quite a few bills that have moved Oregon faster forward than any of us anticipated. When the Energy Department started back in the 70s, we had to twist people's arms to listen to us. We were kind of strange people. Now everybody's interested in energy, and we have a lot of organizations out there promoting energy efficiency. The public purpose charges was a wonderful legislative push in the right direction for Oregon. We've accomplished a great deal of energy efficiency through that. The Oregon Department of Energy administers two portions of the Senate Bill 1149 public purpose funds, one for K through 12 schools and one for the industrial self-direct customers. The agency also administers the State Energy Efficient Design Program, which requires existing state buildings to reduce their energy use by 20% from 2000, and also requires new buildings to increase their energy efficiency by 20%. Last year we completed 15 new buildings, average savings of about 20.3%, and we had three what we call seed award winners, one from Tillamook Forestry, one from the Lakeview Prison, and one from Lane Community College Child Care Center. Amazing projects using renewables and new technologies, all of them saving a huge amount of money. The Lakeview Prison had their geothermal system go down for 1 month in the heating system, and their gas bill was $30,000. So their geothermal heating system is saving that institution about $30,000 a month in the heating season. Excellent program. We've also worked with state agencies and universities to establish some guidelines for them to use when they're preparing to lease buildings, energy audits, checklists, establishing energy uses indexes. So that's moving forward. 1.5% solar is a program that we utilize for state and local governments, K through 12, and Those entities report voluntarily to us on utilization of 1.5% of the capital budget for solar. We also run a number of residential programs and, of course, the business energy tax credit and residential energy tax credit. Since 2006, the volume of VETC applications has increased about 46%. Huge program. We have a great participation rate across the state in both PacifiCorp and PGE service territory, as well as in the local PUD service territory. So it's a program that works statewide with all the utilities. Another bill that was passed last session dealt with appliance standards. We are continuously updating our appliance standards in cooperation with California and Washington. And this year we're looking at California standards on plasma TV, big screen TVs. Oregon doesn't regulate plug loads in residential construction nor in commercial construction, and TVs are a big energy source for homes, so they're coming up with some standards at the federal level, and California's looking at standards to establish. And questions?
Great. Thank you. It seems like a whirlwind. I can't believe we worked on that many bills last session, but very exciting. I know you guys are very busy, and we'll see more of you soon to talk about proposed legislation. Do you have any? Do you want to share any thoughts about the energy efficiency working group, since you worked with that group and the proposed legislation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the group worked so well because of the chairmanship of Bill Edmonds and Clark Brockman. They were on task, good taskmasters, and they kept people on course, which is how they got their job done, on time, on schedule.
And under budget, since we weren't paying them.
Or
within budget, I should say.
Cookies and coffee.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, the bills in the little two-sided, the bills that would be from the Energy Efficiency Working Group would be Senate Bill 79, which is the first one, would be the second one. I'm sorry, not the second one. The fourth one down, which is the Renewable Energies Incentive Bill. The Energy Efficient Incentives, House Bill 2181. And on the back side, Senate Bill 201 would be the bills out of that committee. The other bills on this list are out of other task force, the Renewable Energy Working Group as well. So there were a number of task force running at the same time. The groups prepared reports for the governor's office, and a group of policies and bills were selected to move forward.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions for the department? All right, thanks. I know we'll be seeing you a lot in this committee this session.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Okay, next up is, I've lost my agenda, but I think we have the Oregon Energy Trust. Margie Harris is Executive Director. Thank you for coming back, Margie. I think this is the fifth or sixth time I've asked you to come in front of my committee, but gets better every time, so we appreciate it. And Ms. Harris is going to talk about the Energy Trust programs and how that's connected with the public purposes charge, and provide a little more background on energy efficiency. And certainly I'm sure you'll have some questions for Margie at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For coming once again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today on a sunny day and talk to you about solar energy in Oregon. I'm going to introduce you to the Energy Trust as Senator Dingfelder, I'm not used to saying senator, has said, right, and provide you some background. I'll describe our accomplishments to you and the benefits that those investments in our state deliver. And I look forward to answering any questions you may have along the way or at the conclusion of my remarks. I'm proud to say that Energy Trust has served all of your constituents, and that we have projects in each of your districts, and that's a nice accomplishment. We work in a majority of the state. So if you look on page 2 of the handout, there's a brief history here. Others have already touched on the distinctive position that the state of Oregon has claimed over the years. Many years ago when I was younger, I worked at the Oregon Department of Energy and was their representative here in this building during the time that the first laws were being written, and I'm so proud that we have a history that has extended from those times in the 70s into the times we are in now, and there's so much momentum and attention being focused on conservation and renewable energy policy and programs. In 1999, this legislature adopted the Electric Utility Restructuring Law, and that law stipulated a 3% public purpose charge. It's a charge on the bills of customers for two of our electric utilities in the state, both PGE, Portland General Electric, and Pacific Power customers pay that 3%. The 3%, as Betty from the Department of Energy said, is distributed in different ways to programs that they help manage. And the largest percent of it, about 74%, flows to the Energy Trust of Oregon. Subsequent to the 1999 law, Northwest Natural was the first natural gas utility in the nation to decouple, to separate their earnings from their sales. And as a result, they approached the Energy Trust and asked us to deliver programs on behalf of their customers. And following that time, Cascade Natural Gas also entered. So Energy Trust is in the position now to serve natural gas customers, electric customers, and to deliver both energy efficiency and renewable energy programs. The most recent action taken by the Oregon Legislature was in 2007 when Senate Bill 838 passed. And although it's most renowned for being a renewable portfolio standard, within the law, there is also a piece of the legislation which speaks to increasing funding for energy efficiency by PGE and Pacific Power above the base 3% public purpose charge. That, in fact, has happened, and both utilities have come forward with their proposed energy efficiency plans that build on that 3% public purpose charge. We have an additional 1% that we're able to invest on behalf of customers as a result of those plans. The mission of the Energy Trust is very straightforward and simple. It has to do with change, and the change that we are after is in how we invest in and how we produce power for Oregonians. And we're doing that through efficiency, and we're doing that through renewable energy. The programs that we provide are for every type of customer: residential, commercial, and industrial, agricultural, public institution, and nonprofit. The approach that we use is very much to retrofit existing buildings, both commercial and residential. It's also to provide expertise for builders, architects, engineers, designers when they're building new buildings, and to tap into solar, hydro, biopower, geothermal, and wind power. And all of those are part of the legislation. We offer our neutral, objective information to serve customers, and we, after providing information on the opportunity that's available, we provide financial incentives. We also try to move the customer forward to taking action, because that's when we acquire the actual savings and results that we are after. You've already heard from Bill Edmonds, who described our savings, and you have in your packet of material additional detail about that. You have a one-pager that describes the savings overall since our inception in 2002. And then you have fact sheets that look like this for each of our utility partners that we work with. And that breaks down the delivery of savings as a resource or renewable energy as a resource by utility. So you can see the types of projects and the types of accomplishments we've had by working with our utilities. The statistic that you heard earlier from Bill about enough clean energy to power nearly 250,000 homes is something that we are glad to be making progress toward. Each year we add to that figure substantially. It took a couple of years to get established and ramp up, and we're soaring right now, and the interest in this field has driven a lot of customers our way. We count other benefits besides direct energy benefits, and these are summarized on this next page, and they have to do with what we are able to deliver to the utilities. We are treating energy efficiency as a resource that can be acquired and can help offset the need for new power plants and the need for new generation. The cost of new generation is many times that of energy efficiency. The cheapest kilowatt is the one that we don't have to generate. That's the one that we save. So you can see the difference between 2.4 cents per kilowatt hour and 6 to 8 cents for a new power plant. And we have reduced utility demand and load. Load is what we map to or prepare for, and we've been able to reduce it overall by 4.3%, and you can see the breakdown by sector here. What we do at the Energy Trust and what others in this room have described is good for Oregon and good specifically for our economy. We have independent analyses of what we've been able to do to stimulate activity in our economy, and the results of those analyses indicate an additional $43 million in wages stemming from the Energy Trust programs, $7 million in new business income, over 1,300 new jobs, and nearly 1,000 stronger Oregon businesses. I'd like to point out that when we do this type of activity in energy efficiency and renewables, a lot of the dollars that would otherwise be spent on energy stay within our state and flow within our local economy and help stimulate local jobs. We also track carbon emissions, and you've heard some statistics about this. Our programs have saved over 1.05 million tons of carbon dioxide, and I've given you some equivalence there. That's equal to removing 185,000 cars. I guess I lost the word cars last night when I was working on this, but it's equal to removing 185,000 cars from our roads last year. That was 1 year's activity. Cumulatively, we're at 3.2 million tons of carbon that's not in the air because of the activities that we pursue. And that is equal to removing 555,000 cars from roads every year. The Energy Trust model is unique in the nation. There are only two other nonprofit organizations, one in Vermont and one in Wisconsin, that do the type of work we do using a system benefit charge. The thing that distinguishes us from those other two nonprofit organizations is the working relationship that we have forged with all of the utilities that we work with, including Cascade Natural Gas. We are mission-driven and focused. Our sole purpose is to acquire energy efficiency and energy conservation and renewables. That's all we do. I think having stable and consistent funding through the public purpose charge takes away any of the angst that might have previously existed when people didn't know what the funding might be year to year. We also have very low administrative costs, and we farm out a lot of our activity to other bidders who know a lot about energy efficiency and renewables. That stimulates the economy and adds to jobs here. We are accountable to the Board of Directors, which is a nonprofit volunteer, non-stakeholder board, and to the Public Utility Commission, and I'll get to a little more detail about our working relationship with them just shortly, and ultimately to the ratepayers who support all of our activities. And we try to function very openly. Our meetings are open to the public. We have a stakeholder group of advisory members for both energy efficiency and renewables. All of our information is posted on our website, which is the main tool people use to find out about our services and our products. Coming to the end here, we have a contractual working relationship with the Public Utility Commission in Oregon. If you think about them setting the minimum standards for our performance or the floor, our board of directors sets the stretch goals, and those are the maximum. The PUC also reviews all of our annual budgets. They receive our action plan, which is for a two-year time period, and review that as well. We provide quarterly reports to them. There is an annual report to the legislature as well. We are conducting management audits every 5 years or so, and we'll be undertaking that this year for completion next year. And the PUC, importantly, I think, provides a public forum for a lot of discussion about our programs and the job that we are doing. Lastly, I think there are many, many opportunities in this field, and you've heard some described here today. There's a strong and direct linkage between energy efficiency and renewables and climate change and carbon. And those linkages help us leverage the public mindset around these issues, the public policy around these issues. We have the potential to capture another 650 average megawatts of electric savings, and I'll fill in a blank for you, and it's another 153 million therms of natural gas. When we endeavor to target particular markets to capture more energy savings or take advantage of renewable opportunities, we do so as a result of what's called a resource potential study, looking at where those opportunities are. And we plan to continually tick off how much savings we can get from particular parts of the markets. You've heard about financing. We think financing is a barrier that should be removed and allow people to make larger investments in energy efficiency and renewables as a result of not having to come up with as much capital at the front end. They will also derive their benefits right away, and their savings, as you've heard, can help amortize their upfront investment cost. We have more demand for our renewable energy programs, particularly solar electric and for commercial scale solar electric, than we have resources. And 2 years from now, we will have to decide how many and what types of renewable programs we can offer if our funding is to remain status quo. If it were to change and grow, we would be able to, I think, meet that demand and still have the diversity of technologies offered. I think it's very important that we reach underserved markets. These are the people who are being most hit because of income levels. We work very hard to work in the rural parts of the state, to serve renters, to serve lower income people, not the lowest income, which are served differently under the public purpose charge, but to coordinate with all of those programs and make sure no one is missing out on the opportunity to save. And lastly, a challenge and an opportunity both is to maintain momentum and focus on energy efficiency and renewables during times where people are hurting financially and when the market is in such a downturned place. For example, we do many projects in the southern part of the state in Douglas County where there's a lot of concern about the health and welfare of lumber companies and paper products companies and so on in other parts of the state. So we want to make sure that we're continuing to deliver benefit to those during these hard economic times and helping businesses remain competitive. I'm happy to take whatever questions you might have, and thank you again for the opportunity to be here.
Okay, thank you very much, Margie. Any questions for Ms. Harris? I just one clarification, since it's not in your handout, but you're 501c3.
We are a nonprofit independent entity, and thank you for bringing that point up, Madam Chair.
Just wanted to remind folks. And then service areas that you operate within?
Correspond to the utility customers that we serve. So it's all of PGE, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural, Oregon customers, and Cascade, Oregon customers.
Okay. Great. Okay, thank you for this very thorough presentation. And again, we look forward, I'm sure we'll be asking for your input at other hearings.
Thank you.
Thank you. And actually, I'm going to call up the last three people together. So we can pull up one more chair. But and folks will have about 5 to 8 minutes each, because I want to leave time for questions as well. So I'm going to call up Chris Bristow, Jim Edelson, and Gina Franzosa. And when you state your name for the record, if you can also give a little bit of background on each of your organizations, that would be helpful. I know you are all involved in different elements of energy efficiency. Oh, we have hired help here. Thank you.
The old pros are around.
Yeah. Okay. No problem. We're going to try to leave end early anyway. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for coming. Why don't we start on this side of the dais?
Okay.
And I was going to say you're okay. We actually can hear you fine with these new microphones. It's great.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senators and staff. My name is Chris Bristow with McKinstry. Offering a little different perspective today, I'm a part of the green economy, a part of implementing these funds that are distributed in Oregon through the Oregon Department of Energy and the Energy Trust into actual projects. I have a little presentation here, probably more for my benefit to be able to follow along and get what I want set out. But if you flip to the first one, just a little bit about us so you know where we're coming from. We're a $450 million private design build firm. Demand and renewable projects, in other words, lighting projects, boiler projects, those types of things, and photovoltaics and other things, approximately one-third of our business. Primarily focused in Oregon and Washington, we are currently constructing a 120,000 square foot LEED office in Portland right now. As a mechanical contractor, that is a very rare occurrence, and it has to do with the fact that the state is so aggressive with its energy incentives and has really allowed us to grow. I know that it was mentioned by the working group that California is number one and we're number two in terms of energy efficiency. Well, having worked there for a decade and done about as much demand-side projects as anybody in that area, I can tell you that the business energy tax credit program offered through the Oregon Department of Energy and the Energy Trust of Oregon's existing building program definitely is more aggressive and easier to work with and accomplishes more than the programs that I saw in California. Policy-wise, they may be aggressive, but actually implementation-wise, this state has been wonderful to work with and is a big reason why I'm there. So in 5 years, just to give some perspective, we've grown from 3 energy employees and 80 total in Oregon to 23 energy employees and 187 employees in Portland and Salem. And once again, that's largely as a result of the Department of Energy's programs and Energy Trust of Oregon's. The BETCs are a huge reason why we are able to implement demand-side projects in municipal applications for the most part. SB 1149 and 838 funds, as you know, for the schools, the public purpose charge, the funds used for the schools. We are able to implement projects where they simply are no dollars to implement otherwise using that funding stream. Energy Trust of Oregon, existing building program, very good to work with, a can-do program that has also contributed quite a bit to get these programs done. And also the BPA programs as well have contributed quite a bit. As a result, we've implemented about $55 million in Oregon in the last 5 years of demand-side projects in local government facilities for the most part. They've primarily focused in the rural areas, which is kind of the interesting part. Our projects usually happen where there are no capital funds otherwise available to do these projects. These energy monies are combined with the energy savings generated by the project and the financing mechanism to self-fund the project. In other words, the revenue stream equates to the deficit of the loan over a certain amount of years, and we guarantee that. That has allowed a lot of entities that couldn't otherwise get projects done to be implemented. And what's really interesting about, you know, several times we'll be in a project in the summer, say in Days Creek, Oregon, where there are no other projects go on other than this energy project. So it does quite a bit for the renewable communities. And I just want to reemphasize that they wouldn't have happened without these programs. They're very fine programs and very well-documented and streamlined programs. Flipping over to the examples that I have, some of our rural customers, you know, and when we go to these rural communities, we're using rural subcontractors too, so the local folks are getting the work. We act as a construction manager. We do self-perform some scopes, but a lot of the local folks are getting work through these energy programs. UCC, or Umpqua Community College in Douglas County, I thought I'd raise that because they are proceeding with their program this summer despite the economic times because they view it as a jobs program. they know it's self-funds, but they know that it's also going to contribute to much-needed jobs within Douglas County. So you can just look through the list and you see how many rural counties that we're in, and this is just a very short list of our examples, but I thought I'd bring that up to share how extensive it is in rural Oregon. The next slide is, and I won't spend long on this, but just an example of a project that we do. Enterprise School District in Wawa, big metropolis out there, right? You know, schools circa 1912, 1930, those types of things. Using lots of fuel oil, ancient systems as far as their infrastructure, and no funds at all for the upgrade. And if you look at the graph on the following slide, this is kind of how it works. Their old utility budget is the big red on the left, and then what we're able to do is reduce their utility budget to the middle, and then you see the debt service there, and I don't really show a bucket for the incentives, but if you look on the right-hand column, this was a $1.9 million project that received a $522,000 renewable Betsy, which was the only reason this project was able to move forward. And what it was is the installation of a biomass boiler system that burns wood chips, or in other words, natural resources within the area. So if you flip to the back page, you'll see a picture of a brand new building with a biomass boiler contained in it. And we are currently now using local fuel in that boiler, completely carbon neutral, supplying the heating needs for the school complex. Not that it hasn't been run into its issues. You know, frozen fuel in December didn't help anything. But we're standing behind it, and it's certainly going to be a very successful project. So from my industry perspective, I congratulate you in Oregon, Oregon Department of Energy, Energy Trust. I would not be able to have a job in this state were it not for you folks. Obviously, extending these programs is crucial to us in order to make this happen. As I look at the working groups, item number 7, the 50% Betsy for industrial projects, industry doesn't like to move forward on long-return projects, right? They don't know if they're going to be around tomorrow, whereas municipal government can move on 15-year returns. There are multiple million-dollar projects out there that have five-year or less returns that industry doesn't want to move forward with, especially in tricky economies, because they're not sure they'll be in that facility for that long of a term, right? To add that impetus to it would really help substantially in that aspect. So that's really all I have to say. If there's any questions.
Thank you. I think we're going to go work through the panel to stay on time, and then we'll take time for questions at the end. Thank you very much for that excellent presentation.
That's cool.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Gina Franzosa, and I'm the Oregon State Director with the Cascadia Region Green Building Council. Cascadia is a network of over 10,000 building industry professionals across Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska. We are a 501c3 organization, and our mission is to promote the design, construction, and operation of buildings that are environmentally responsible, economically profitable, and healthy for the people that live, work, and learn in them. Our membership is very diverse, from contractors to architects to engineers, building owners, and now even brokers, lenders, appraisers. And they're advancing the concept of high-performance buildings both locally and around the world. And they're now particularly focused on mitigating climate change through their work, recognizing the opportunity and the responsibility that they have in reducing the building industry's lion's share of carbon emissions. I'm sure you're aware, but in case not, building, operation, and construction represents more carbon emissions than the transportation sector. So this is a prime area of opportunity, and it's a very important topic to be discussing today. Interestingly, Oregon's concerted focus on energy efficiency that began 30 years ago sparked what is now the robust and thriving green building community. And it was recognized then and remains true today that the green building and energy efficiency are complementary, if not inextricably interwoven. And this focus and investment in energy efficiency over the past 30 years has led to job creation and myriad benefits for Oregon's economy, as well as a portfolio of some of the continent's highest performing buildings and homes, and a competitive advantage for Oregon in a global economy that is rapidly learning from our successes. And this is an advantage that we stand to lose if we don't act quickly. But however, in spite of this great work, the work that you've heard about from the previous speakers, and truly incredible acquisition of energy efficiency, I've heard other statistics talking about how energy efficiency has actually met a dramatic increase in energy demand over the past 20 years, carbon emissions from the building sector continue to rise. So what is needed, you know, is really approximately a 100-fold amplification of all of the efforts that you've heard about today that have been taking place and developing over the past 30 years, you know, to address this very large challenge. We can't afford, you know, to not act boldly. And further, what is really needed, what I'd like to underscore, is that a comprehensive approach is quite critical. Oregon has to date employed one strategy that has been a clear driver, and I think it's been reinforced by everyone that's spoken, is that incentives have helped put us in this leadership position. However, the marketplace needs a much clearer signal through comprehensive policy and state action in this legislative session in order to respond appropriately. And so, on behalf of the Council, I'd like to propose the following framework to guide your policymaking efforts, and this pretty much mirrors, you know, the policy proposals you're getting from the Energy Efficiency Working Group, which I also did serve on.
Okay. And, Gina, I was going to suggest, since we have the sheet in front of us, instead of because we can read it, maybe you could just, if there's a couple of key points that you want to add, because we've heard about some of these proposals already. So are there, of the ones you've heard, are there the list here, are there some that you really feel are, key? That,
and it relates to one of the questions that you asked earlier. And the idea of an overarching vision and adopting the 2030 challenge, or goal of achieving net zero energy buildings by the year 2030, actually is a standard, is a goal that is being adopted by cities. It was adopted by the U.S. Council of Mayors, the City of Seattle, major institutions, and the Federal General Services Administration have all adopted the challenge as their standard for building. So we believe that that's an utterly critical one. Furthermore, we believe, that the building code and the roadmap is critical. It provides, you know, an indicator to the industry, and it'll then be poised to change and reflect those new standards. The other piece of information that I wanted to talk about that hasn't been discussed much, and Bill alluded to it, is the investment in workforce training and public education. There is a lot of investment and a lot of participation on behalf of the private sector and nonprofits who do fundraising to make this stuff happen, but there is needed a coordinated effort. I understand that the university system is considering this. Lane Community College has a great energy-related program that they're looking at moving across the state. So we have that to look forward to, though you will not see it in a policy proposal. And then also an outreach and education campaign. Again, no proposal came forward from the Energy Efficiency Working Group on that. You have my article here that you can read. I think the story out of Juneau, Alaska, sort of underscores the importance of this topic, so I hope that you won't let public education, public awareness kind of fall off the table. So thank you for this opportunity. The industry, you can count on the industry support, and is eager to see clear action, clear direction from the state in an aggressive manner on this topic.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Gina. I appreciate your input. And like I said, I know we'll be hearing more, and you'll be probably testifying on some of these bills in the committee later on. So appreciate you coming and providing sort of an overview. Mm-hmm. And Jim, you get to wrap it up.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Jim Edelson. I'm a climate and energy consultant in Portland, Oregon. I represented the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and its Oregon Interfaith Power and Light Project on the Governor's Carbon Allocation Task Force in 2006, and also on the Energy Efficiency Working Group, which we've heard about today. Oregon Interfaith places a very high priority on energy efficiency in this policy advocacy because it both delivers reductions in greenhouse gases quickly, cost-effectively, and it also furthers social justice goals by creating much-needed jobs and reducing bills for low-income consumers. So we've gone through a lot today, so I'll try and summarize the points we haven't done. But the message I do want to deliver and reinforce is that energy efficiency is the critical lever in executing the climate and energy strategy for the state. It's been shown time and time again to be the most cost-effective approach, and that's one thing we definitely learned at the Carbon Allocation Task Force. In terms of weatherization and other energy efficiency measures, they can make a huge difference for low-income consumers by lowering the energy bills month after month. And because once you've installed them, the ongoing price for an avoided kilowatt hour or an avoided therm is zero, a very consistent zero, a very stable zero. It is the right approach for lowering bills in the long term. But the right public support, what you're going to look at this session, is needed to get those programs widespread. One thing we did talk about a lot at our committee hearings is, well, Oregon's achieved a lot. Have we just grabbed all the low-hanging fruit? And we frequently have philosophical discussions. Do the low-hanging fruit grow back? Well, I want to answer this definitive question. The Northwest Power Planning Council will come out later this year with their sixth power plan, and they're going to show that despite all the achievements we have made to date in Oregon, at least as much as we've saved to date can still be saved cost-effectively in the future. That much has grown on the trees. It grows back because of technology. It grows back because of programs like the Energy Trust of Oregon, and it grows back because of the Betsy. These programs, I mean, these opportunities are available, and we'll see them time after time. One other thing I want to point out is the memo that I attached to the back of my testimony. This is developed for me by the American Council for Energy Efficiency Economy, the same group that Bill Edmonds mentioned earlier today. And they've done a meta-analysis of over 34 studies across the country. And you can read the memo itself, but I want to summarize the critical data for Oregon based on 2006 published economic accounts for the state suggests that the combined natural gas and electric utility sectors provide an average of only 1.5 direct jobs per $1 million of revenue, whereas all other sectors of the economy, on average, produce an average of 7.9 jobs per $1 million of revenue. So this is hard data that shows why Margie's programs and Bill and natural gas programs and the Betsy is producing an economic job gain for this state. And this occurs time and time again. The more money we invest in energy efficiency, the more jobs we do create. And I also now want to address the Gina talked a little bit about the 2030 bill. And as a member of the working group, I think that was one of the most important policies passed out of the committee, and it will be in your SB 79. It is accurate that, as Bill said, that no other state has adopted this mandatorily statewide. I also serve as a consultant for the New Buildings Institute, and I am right now working with dozens of other states and cities to implement the advanced building codes across the country. From the District of Columbia to Seattle, from Portland itself to San Antonio. If you look at Section 6 of SB 79, these near-term goals of 30% for commercial buildings and 15% for residential buildings, these are standards that are being adopted nationwide. Not necessarily by the federal government, but by individual states and individual cities and districts. And the 2030 goal is being adopted by certain state agencies, such as the California Energy Commission and the administrative agencies in Minnesota. So I think we do need to look at this 2030 challenge as a very serious opportunity to provide the roadmap for our energy codes going forward. So, driven by climate policy and a desire to reduce fuel bills, this energy efficiency revolution is happening nationwide, being assisted by governors and legislatures and mayors and city councils. There may never be a better year to do this, and the toolbox is open. Let's take the opportunity and use these tools. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel?
One quick question.
Sure, Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Chris, you mentioned use a Eastern Oregon example. Where are they getting their wood mass? Since timber industry is basically in the toilet in Wallowa County.
Yeah, and I'm not the lead on that, used to be getting it from a mill, I believe. It's being shipped now from a local rancher. I think that was the latest fuel source. We had a lot of trouble with the fuel supply at first being too stringy. For it to be augured up, and we actually, I believe, have a contract with a local rancher to slash, basically. So there's various sources. Douglas County has a tremendous interest in trying to clean up the slash off the side of the highway and burn it as a fuel source, and so we're looking into that with them as well.
Right. And, Madam Chair, just
follow up.
No to you.
Okay.
And that's one of the challenges is getting business integrated here. Because I could tell you right now that fuel for the next 3 years could have been gotten in this particular place very easily, except a lack of coordination between various agencies. resulted in, you know, timber companies slash piling and burning
at least a
2-year supply of fuel
for biomass,
within a few miles of that high school.
I'm sure we have a lot of still kinks and coordination that needs to be worked out, because I've certainly heard similar stories, but I think that's something that we're going to have to, you know, with the agencies working together and obviously with private sector and other public agencies such as other federal agencies where there's opportunities as well.
Right.
So, any other questions? Jean, did you want to add?
I could add, yeah.
Sure.
That 2 years ago, the legislature approved an investment in what's called the Oregon Bioeconomy and Sustainable Technology Center, and that center is now seeking to facilitate connections between the marketplace and at least the research institutions to take advantage of Oregon's natural resources and promote economic development in the state. So there is a history of investment in that area that policies like this would certainly complement.
Great. Okay. Any other comments?
Just, Madam Chair, we mean squarely have Department of Forestry in my crosshairs here.
Yeah. we'll be talking to them at some point, I'm sure.
Yes, we will, Madam Chair.
So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting, although I have a couple of housekeeping items. So I wanted to thank you very much, all of you, for coming here today and your work and interest. And, again, I think we'll probably be hearing from your members, I know for sure, Gina, and certainly appreciate, and if you'd like to come back to testify on the bills, that would be really helpful. So with that, I'm going to close the informational portion of our meeting. Just a couple of housekeeping things. We will be meeting until 5. I anticipate with the workload of this committee that we will probably need all the given time the committee has allocated from 3 to 5. I do plan to start on time, so I appreciate if folks can get here on time because of the tight time frame we have. And our next meeting is on January 20th at 3 p.m., and we'll be holding an informational meeting on water issues. So that should be interesting. I'm sure we'll be hearing lots of different thoughts on some of the water bills will be coming in front of our committee. And as you probably can tell, energy and water are two big themes that we'll be working with throughout the session. So with that, I want to thank everyone for coming today. Beth, did you have any other housekeeping notes that you need?
Nope.
Okay, great. With that, we will adjourn.